Hey Richard, thank you very much for agreeing to talk to me. Racecourse commentator is not that common a job, so can you give us a bit of a background into your racing past?
Mine's a bit of those nauseous things about a good break, really, because racing was my sport when I was a kid. You know, everyone else went to football, I went racing on a Saturday. Up and down the country, really came from, not from a horse background, it was really a numbers background. I've always been very comfortable with numbers. So it was the sort of form, like the fact that I could occasionally come back with a little bit more money than I went out with on a Saturday, whereas, you know, my mates had done 20 quid watching football, and maybe sometimes it's a good game, sometimes it's a bad game. But there's one, I was thinking, sort of one in every class, really, that follows racing and follows it right the way through. So it was a love of racing initially. I had no idea you could really work in it. I never came, as I say, from a horse background. Clearly was never going to be a jockey or anything like that. Last time I weighed 87, I was about 11. So as a result, it was just really an interest. My careers master, who astonishingly enough is now the only person from my school who I meet regularly on a race course, never divulged his interest in racing whatsoever, even though mine must have been pretty obvious when I was at school. And I went into accountancy. I qualified as an accountant, going racing every weekend when I could. And basically that's where the two paths were completely going in different directions. And then one day there was an advert in the Racing and Sporting Life, as it was then. And for various complicated reasons, basically my accountancy career, 92, there was a recession. I qualified really young and early, but because people were getting very conservative, they weren't appointing people as sort of financial directors anymore at such a young age of 25 for sort of a division. So I was basically faced with 18 months kicking my heels, doing all the bits of the CV you didn't want to do. And I'd never gone to, I went to poly rather than university, so I decided I'd try and do something I really wanted to with the qualification behind me, and that was racing. So basically I wrote lots of letters to absolutely everyone with very little response until that day. That effort was in the Sporting Life, really. And again, it's just someone giving you the opportunity. I think right the way through whatever anybody does, it is somebody being brave enough to give you an opportunity. I was so naive, I didn't even realise you had to send in a demo tape. So my mum's partner at the time worked in TV, and as a favour to her, when I realised I had to send in a demo tape, we sort of created a studio in my mum's living room. And after about three races, when we'd had a try, much to my amazement, he stopped. Well, it wasn't my amazement, he stopped. I was thinking he was going to tell me, that's it, thanks very much, and done what we can. But he looked as surprised as I did, and said he actually thought I could do it. And we sort of worked from there, worked on a demo tape, and then went through the sort of recruitment process. But I never expected to get the job, for sure. Just kept getting to the next stage, next stage, next stage. There were two jobs really going. It was the time SIS were employing their own commentators, replacing what had been the traditional type of commentary on course. And John Hunt and myself were the two that got the jobs at the end of the process. So never grew up wanting to be a commentator, never contemplated being a commentator until that advert was in the paper. So it's a bit of an unusual way in. And when kids come to you now and sort of say, what do I have to do? I would feel a bit of a fraud, really, because they can't really replicate the way that I managed to get into it, really. Just need someone to give you that opportunity.
Okay, Richard, so obviously you had a first meeting where you commentated. Can you remember where it was and how it went?
Yeah, it was funny because we sort of started in stages. Once we were told, when we got down to the last two or three, that if you were any good, you'd go out with a racecourse commentator and obviously, you know, watch what they did. But we were trying to do something different then. It was SIS, George Irvin and Mick Embleton, really trying to take you away from the racecourse commentators, so there weren't enough of us to go out with each other. So basically when I got the call to go to Hereford and do just an audio meeting in those days, now we're so used to seeing everything in vision, but in those days not all the meetings were in vision. So you used to go and provide a commentary, and then whoever was sitting in the booth would re-speak it sort of half a second later or what have you. It's quite an art to do, actually, and something like several of us went on to do regularly in years to come. But obviously I was the one being re-spoken in those days. Robert Cooper was the poor individual. It was a race at Hereford. I snapped the key to my car off in the petrol tank on the way, as in, you know, this key fob, Sierra it was, and I put it in, went to turn it, and the fob came off the thing and left the key in there, didn't have enough petrol, absolutely panicking, went in, pulled it out with a pair of pliers, arrived there in a right state, and again, nice people who were there, set me at ease. Martin Harris was commentating for Extel there on my very first day. And basically I just did the commentary. It wasn't really going anywhere because Robert was re-speaking it. And I got this message after the fourth race because they were phoning up to ask, you know, how I was getting on. And the fourth race was quite about 16 run a handicap. So it was quite messy. It was quite a tight finish. There was about seven or eight involved for quite a while. And the only message I got back from Coots, was it would be helpful if you could try and keep them in roughly the same order, because obviously I was just going all over the shop. So clearly those early ones were very green. The first meeting I actually ever did formally was on Cup Final Day. I think it was the 5th of May 1992, I think that's right. I think Liverpool were playing Wimbledon in the Cup. But anyway, it was Cup Final Day at Bath. And in those days, as I say, you just were going out to the shop. So it was rather odd, really, because you were just standing in a box on a roof somewhere. You couldn't really believe that you'd be going to all the betting shops up and down the country, and you just did it on your own. And it was a perfectly run-of-the-mill day. But I had an extreme piece of good fortune on my first day. It was somebody else's misfortune, as it happens. And that was that, I think it was the third or fourth race, was an 8-runner handicap. It was really not an overly hard race. It was just a rate of them. And as soon as they crossed the line, I was just aware, because my box was on the roof and lots of people standing outside, that all wasn't exactly well, if you know what I mean. And a couple of people banged on the window, and then some bloke stuck his head in and said, "Well, that wasn't very good, was it?" And I absolutely, beat myself, really, because it's my first day. I'm thinking, what have I done? And it took me a while to rationalise it and realise that they weren't hearing me. So they must have been talking about the racecourse commentary. And what had happened was there were 8 runners in the race. Sheikh Mohammed had 2 first and second colours. And it didn't matter who the racecourse commentator was that day, had actually muddled the 2 up. It caused lots of confusion in the shops, because obviously the judge was giving a different result to the commentator. The SIS guys who were reporting from the pitch naturally went with the more experienced guy, because when they called through to the text room to check, it was a different result. Richard's called a different result to what's on course. Well, it's his first day, isn't it? So the wrong result actually for a while went out into the shops. And it turned out that I was right. I hadn't done anything other than called an 8-runner race, probably pretty poorly, but at least I put them in the right order. And as a result, on the way home, I was getting phone calls from people quite high up in SIS saying, "That's why we're doing this. That's why, this is the future," and all this. And all I'd done was called an 8-runner race, probably pretty badly, but in the right order. So that was my first day. It was quite a memorable one. John Hunt started on exactly the same day, and we certainly gave each other a lot of moral support in those early days. So that's how it all started. As regards what we do sort of on a daily basis, most preparation starts the night before. I print out colour sheets that you can get off the Racing Post website. In the old days, we actually used to draw all these by hand. And in a way, even though it was an absolute pain to do, it gave you a massive advantage, because in those days they weren't in the paper. You were the only one who really knew the colours. As long as you were pretty decisive, then you could be pretty happy that you knew more than the person watching. Whereas these days, everyone's got a copy. We may come onto in running later as the impact it's had on what people want when they listen to a commentary from the past. But basically, it's colour recognition. We tend not to learn them until they go to post, very late, because you don't want to confuse them from one race to the next. Silly things as well, like every trainer and jockey's first name, I'll religiously write out. I know it's Frankie Dettori, but I also know that I've looked at every single one then. My personal things like orange for greys, yellow for mares, I'll still call he, she's and she's, he's, and I know it really gets on trainers' wicks in particular, but it's hard for us to distinguish the difference, obviously, in the commentary. And then other bits of information, just enough course map at the bottom as well. So if we were looking at flat, you'd have the draw as you'd see it, number of flights and fences marked out, really. I'm a big believer in walking the course, partly because I need to. You sit in the car a long time, and anyone who tries to eat on the road knows it ain't the most healthy. But since I've started walking courses, it's been probably one of the best things I've done, probably about 10 years ago when I really started. You see the changes from rail positions, you get to meet the ground staff. Clerks of the course particularly like it, because you can talk their language and you can understand a bit more. And it just means that when you're filling, really, while working out what's going on, you instinctively know where they are. Water jumps are still there, open ditches are still in the same place, that sort of thing. So we walk the course, printed out all this in advance, whatever it is that you wanted to do, and notations of where they last won. I also put a betting market in as well, probably can't make that out, but the prices overnight, basically just so I can compare it then to the prices just before they go to the off, so I'm aware if something's been backed. And let's face it, if I've got a choice of two horses that I don't know the difference between one and the other, if one of them's down as a 3-1 chance and one of them's down as a 6-1 chance, if I've really got to guess, and there have been times in the course of your career for various reasons where you might have to, then you might as well play the percentages and go for the 3-1 chance rather than a 6-1 shot. But fortunately, that doesn't happen too often. Go to the weighing room, check the non-runners, speak to the clerk of the scales just to check there's no colour changes, no jockey changes, and also just go and say hello to the crew and the cameramen. commentary is quite a lonely profession in many ways, and you can actually do virtually the entire day with not speaking to many people if you want to, but it hides the fact that we are just the sort of vocal piece of a massive operation that goes round from course to course. And I can't stress highly enough how underrated cameramen are out in all weathers trying to provide us the pictures, and how important it is to try and work with your director in the truck, work out exactly what it is they want from you and what it is you can glean from them. I'll leave everybody turned up. They can yell at me during the race if I'm about to cock up. I want 15 people telling me rather than me having turned everything down. And just be aware from who you're commentating for as well, probably.
Sometimes, Richard, when you look at the race card, you must see a name and think, oh, great.
How much we pre-prepare and everything, I think, is, you know, pre-prepared whole lines, to my mind at least, just don't work. It's trying to force a round peg into a square hole. Everything happens live. But there's no doubt that some horses' names, some race days as well, you know, the biggest danger to making mistakes tends to be when you switch off. It tends not to be the high-profile races. It tends to be those six or seven races where you haven't learned them properly, you haven't done the discipline, you really think it's going to be easy, and your brain doesn't have all of those safeguards or, you know, normal processes you go through to stop you cocking up. So on smaller days, quite often we'll have some fun either with the scanner, particular word to get into a commentary, I don't know, an association with a name, and sometimes you see names and yeah, there'll be something you can immediately associate with a particular name, whether it be a band, for example. You try, and we did an ABBA night. It was an ABBA tribute band playing up after racing in Epsom. It was a five runner race, and what have you, it was a mile and a half. I think we managed to get 11 ABBA titles into the commentary, hopefully without it really sounding absolutely ridiculous, because that, obviously that's going a step too far. But it's nice on a family day in particular, I think, if you can just not take yourself too seriously, and some horses' names really lend themselves open to others. There are, of course, lots of other horses' names, however, just before we move off, horses' names that fill you with absolute dread. The most famous of which, you know, were the likes of the spoonerism, like Mary Hinch, one of the two ugly sisters in the spoof Cinderella. Fortunately, the intended half-sister, Betty Swallocks, got refused the following year from the same owner, thank you. People who name horses to try and trip up commentators. They're lovely horses. Why on earth would you name your horse, well, Bitch for one, Hellcat, Mud Wrestler, both from the same owner. Gorn, My Son, which I think might have been Oliver Reed's horse, actually, which might have been funny the first time, but when you've got to keep saying it, it gets a bit monotonous. I remember being scared stiff when I had to call Winker Watson in one of my first Royal Ascot commentaries. If that had gone pear-shaped in front of Her Majesty, that wouldn't have gone too well. But the one that used to fill me with dread, and it was Ducky Fuzz, a horse of Martin Featherstone Godley's that used to run. It was a 7 furlong handicap. I seem to come across it every single time, because if you haven't played that particular drinking game, which I had when I'd grown up the cricket, it, not only would you like to get it wrong, but in trying to correct it, it would just make it worse. And, you know, the lesson to people is, if you want commentators to pronounce your horse a lot, don't call it ridiculously silly names. So we don't make up things in advance, doesn't work and fit. Sometimes you're not really sure where you're going with certain things, and you're actually just pleased to get something out that sounds plausible. Sometimes you can think of things a long way from home, which you can then deliver quite well, hopefully. The intention is just to support what is out on the track. The race horses are the stars. You're just trying to find words that complement them. I think the one that probably was the scariest was Frankel's Champion Stakes win at the end of his career at Ascot, when everyone was practicing all sorts of lines for the horse that wins 10 lengths all of the time. And if you remember, he fell out the stalls, and that always gave the possibility that A, he wasn't going to win, and B, wasn't going to win by very far, and that means you haven't got much time. And all I remember was that I wanted to have something about the ground, because if you remember, the build up to Frankel's win had been all about soft ground and this sort of thing. And I started saying something, and I just hadn't a clue what the end of it was really going to be, and it sort of came out as something along the lines of all grounds, all comers, all beaten, something like that. And it sort of just about made sense, so I was pretty comfortable that I hadn't cocked it up, and at least I hadn't gone down the unbeaten in 14 or whatever it was route. But the reason that it turned out to be particularly proud from my point of view was just that at the late Henry Cecil's Thanksgiving service, For his life, they printed off the order of service, and there were four individual quotes scattered through, one of which was that quote from the end of that commentary, because it had chimed a chord with Sir Henry and the family and what have you. And the thought from a lad who'd grown up watching all of his horses run and what have you, that in some shape or form you'd actually been able to provide a line that was thought good enough as part of the celebration of the life of possibly the greatest trainer, is still probably one of my proudest moments, even though I know the line was a complete car crash at the time. Thankfully it came out more or less right and conveyed obviously something of the day. The thing with big races is just not to overanalyze them, not get too hung up with things. Just let it happen, just try and relax, try and enjoy it. The commentary I enjoyed most was really came off the back of when our eldest had just been born. I'd had 5 months of no sleep, and every new parent knows exactly what the hell that's like. You're turning up the race course, he's fuggy and just trying to get through the day. It was Cortez Star and Denman's Gold Cup, I think. When you look back on it, it wasn't a particularly interesting race, really. Denman just ran the finish out of all of them one by one, but I've never felt such a response from a crowd before. They just sort of followed every twist and turn, and going out on the final circuit, I think, when Denman just began to assert and Cortez Star made a slight mistake. Can't remember again exactly what it said, but it's something along the lines of Denman's got him at it. And the response from the crowd was like thinking, whoa, you know, it's a long way out here. And you realise then that you could actually not play the crowd, but everyone's got that anticipation and everything. And that, for me, was actually one of the clearest. I can still remember every thought through that final minute and a half, thinking, right, don't, you know, if you go too early, everyone's just going to go berserk. No one will hear things. Everyone's shouting and screaming. So just keep drip feeding it in. Just keep trying to, you know, just next chapter. Is he making more ground? Is he, you know, how much is... And, you know, and it just unfolded all the way down the hill. As I say, it wasn't a particularly exciting race. And then all the way down the hill, when you realise Denman's going to win, you're just trying to think, right, what sums this up? What are you seeing? What are the attributes that Denman's brought to the race? And, you know, I'm thinking, right, he's like a fight. He's kept going. He's just kept pummeling. So, okay, pummeling's a bit, but relentless is good. And as soon as you're relentless, you think, okay, remorseless, that's quite good as well. So they're together. And the pounding bit, Quarter Star on the ropes covering up, you're thinking, okay, pounding, submission, that's a, you know, and all of those, I can remember all of those words being pieced together, knowing that you're likely to have enough time to deliver them, and then it's just don't cock it up. I sort of, the answer is Denman at the end is a bit odd, because never say what the hell the question is, but fortunately everyone else seems to remember what the question was. And it's not that the commentary was particularly good, it was just the anticipation, I think, of everyone there that day and that performance. And I think I've never felt as in tune with a crowd before, and probably will never since, particularly now that it's on TV. But that day, I can still absolutely remember. Everyone seemed twice as buzzed up as I was. I was just calmly moving them around, maybe because I hadn't had the same build-up, because I had no sleep and the kids were, you know. Jack was still very young and focus was possibly less on racing than normal, but that was probably my most enjoyable 2 minutes of commentary, just because it was so clear. I can still recall it so much. I think the worst moments, whenever you call anything wrong, accuracy is the key. I've only ever called one winner across the line wrong. It was at Newmarket. Fortunately, it was before the days of In Running, because there were no financial commutations of that. But I cocked up a Victoria Cup to as good as that, muddling up Wolf's Radish and Hawkeye the New for about 150 yards at a crucial stage of the race. Far too late to get out of it. The key is to give yourself lots of safeguards so you know. You'll make lots of errors. We call 10,000 horses a year, you're going to make lots of errors. It's just you want to know what they are before everyone else does. You want to minimise the chances of that happening, and you want to make sure 15 times a year you've got to have a bullet, and you just want to make sure it wings you rather than sort of cops you straight between the eyes. But, you know, that's the name of the game. It's life. Sometimes it goes well, quite often it doesn't.
So you amazed people recently, Richard, when you commentated at the last minute of race at York, when you were at Newmarket. Has it become such second nature that you can just do it now without...
Yeah, look, really, I think a lot of people felt I was very downplaying of that. I promise you that that wouldn't have been... Virtually every single one of my colleagues could have made a really good fist of that once you don't scare yourself. Because, like, we've all sat in studios and commentated off tube, and that's effectively what you're doing. It was just at Newmarket. Where I was lucky was I actually, for once, was sort of prepared with a paper in front of me just to watch the race. And also the way that they're well-known horses that were in that race. It wasn't as if it was a, you know, a red car two-year-old trophy or a maiden at Newmarket with 30 runners, 5 Hamdans, 3 cars, you know. And they didn't go very fast. And once you had a first run through, thinking, okay, just don't go too fast, just pick them off. And first way through, I knew I got 14 or 15 of them, thinking, okay, there's only five left to find now. And there was only one, it was one, I can't remember which one it was now, but that I hadn't mentioned by halfway. It was the Roger Charm thing, so the Roger Varian thing in grey. And I managed to find that in midfield. And then it's pretty straightforward, really, in terms of the only thing you've got to remember is they're going to, you can't look out the window to see them pass the line. So you just have to begin to wrap up the result a little bit quicker than you would do normally. But again, the director was, you know, in my ear telling me, give me a what we call a creep, which is when you go back to a replay and they creep through slowly. So I knew I had that as a safeguard. All I really had to do was just keep making sure that you knew which horses were itch and sort of not panic in the situation. But I promise you that most people would really have had a pretty good stab at that. Most people who sit in booths have had that situation happen to them several times and would have been able to make a good go. And what's more scary is when it breaks down for you, so your monitor goes, for example, I was calling at Bath the back end of 1 year, last meeting of the season, and two races before the end, everything went, we just lost the power as they were at the post. And my stuff works on battery, so you can still talk, but can't see anything. There's no monitor, there's no nothing. And it turned out they'd unplugged the freezer downstairs because they didn't need it anymore the rest of the season, and they'd unplugged all our, everything else is working, the power next door's working, the power of the cameraman next to me working, we were on the same spur as the freezer. And I hadn't a clue, they were just running away from me, and we use bins where we can, but everyone else was seeing it in glorious technicolour, and you feel a bit of an idiot in that sort of circumstance. You want to tell everyone that you can't, you know, my monitor's not working, I can't see it, they're miles away from me. Newmarket, struck by lightning one day, you know, the stands were, and I stupidly pressed the mic and it came up. I think, well, somewhere around me doing that, but I can't see him around the corner. So you just have to sort of pad and flannel. Fog's horrible. Yeah, fog. That doesn't go too well. But generally, it's nice you've got an interest in a race, whether you just met or know owners. You're tending to give people bad news, so it's quite nice when you give them good news every now and again. I've been lucky enough to call a few winners, but I'll never surpass calling also mine that won a lot of races called Blue Sky, thinking winning Ascot, won his maiden Ascot. And two furlongs out, I remember thinking, you're going to win. You know, logically, I can see you're going to win. It was a nice young horse. And yeah, that was a pretty special day. And it's pretty easy to do, to separate again, you know, your personal feelings from it. Your brain just does one thing, your heart does another. But I must confess, after the line, I'm pretty ballistic, and I'll probably never experience that as an owner again. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. I think the most important thing is to enjoy it. It's an enjoyment sport. And just remember, from my point of view, how lucky you are to get to do it. It's the one thing you set out when I started was, all those years ago, answering the paper, and you know, to give up a job and do a job that most people would absolutely love to do, is just always remember that. Big meeting, small meeting, doesn't matter. Everything's equally important. You're only as good as the next one. And yeah, as I say, you're very lucky to get to do the job. And don't forget that, because there's plenty of take your chance at the blink of an eye if they could.
Okay, Richard, you've just said how much you thoroughly enjoy doing what you do, but what are the downsides of it?
Travel, really. That's about it, I think. And I don't mean travel generally, because travel's normally fine. It's just getting around on the roads. You know, I walk, clock up. Don't do as many miles as I did, but I do 40,000 a year, and everyone who's tried travelling around, stuck on the M6 on a Friday afternoon, you know, you can try and avoid it as much as you can. That's the only real downside. It's not that I don't like driving, perfectly okay, but it's just the logistics of getting about, to be honest. And obviously losing horses as well, you know, we've not time to go into all the welfare issues, but, you know, I'm a very proud supporter of this sport, and I will defend it to the absolute hilt. But where we fail is really communicating some of the perceptions or misconceptions that people have for the sport. But right from when I first saw Fairy King killed in front of me as a race goer, you know, you go away from that, seeing the last come down, one of Jimmy Fitzgerald's good chasers, had a hemorrhage going to the second last, just didn't rise, and you see all that played out in front of you, and you go away and you think about it, and you analyse what the care that horses have, etc., and that they are bred to race, they are race horses. If you decided to curtail or ban racing, you would sign the death knell of immediately, you know, thousands of horses, because they do need to have a commercial value, and they're also much loved pets afterwards for many people. But that's the downside, is when you're aware. My favourite horse, Pegwell Bay, I was on course when he died at Sandown, forever grateful for Jamie Osborne chasing after him to catch him, so his suffering was very, very quick. But they're the two downsides, I suppose, the travel on that. What else would be the downsides? I think for someone starting out now, I think one of the downsides is the, and so it's not so much social media, because I use Twitter quite a lot, but I think forums or whatever, you have to be very thick-skinned when you start out. You know, when you've been doing it for a few years and you've got a bit more experience, then, you know, you can take the name calling and everything else. But the personal abuse and what have you, that are given to so many people, it's not nothing really to do with me specifically. I've been very lucky in that regard. But unfortunately, that is now part of the job. And it's very difficult for someone whose confidence might be easily bruised when they're starting out not to get affected by that sort of thing. Personally, I always like going in and debating. It's why I actually enjoy using Twitter quite a bit. It's a good source of information primarily. It's a good contact point when you want to ask individuals certain questions and what have you, but you have to accept the rough with the smooth as well. But I'll always be happy going on and fighting my corner, but then maybe I've been doing it a fair amount of time and I have that sort of approach anyway. But I feel for some people that can make it a very, very hard way of getting a footing in all sports and even, you know, in life in general. And yeah, I think it's the downside that there's so much personal abuse that goes on it rather than constructive debate. And unfortunately, the former's rather begun to outweigh the latter in certain forums, and Twitter's slightly better because there's less ability to hide behind things. You still can, but it's not quite as easy as it is in other sort of formats. So probably that's a, a negative as well. As regards ambitions, no, not really. The ambitions remains the same as I said when I started, is to keep doing as good a job as you can every single time. You can't accept plaudits when things go well, you know, if you're not prepared to take the sticks and stones when it doesn't go well. So I'll always try and be pretty low key when things do go well. It's nice and everything else, and so is the sort of recognition. I think the main ambition left is to try and make ITV Racing as big a success as we possibly can. Having had my opportunity there, pleased that Racing has really got behind it very constructively, but we still feel there's an awful lot to do. But the team aspect that's been able to be created behind the camera as well as in front has been really one of the great fun things, I think. We're allowed to try and do our job, so I think that's probably that probably is sort of sole remaining ambitions. Outside that, other sporting things, I'm a cider man Somerset fan since a kid. Those of you with long memories remember the JPL 40 over league that used to be on a Sunday. I started, the titles were all of the county badges, and Somerset's is a, what I thought was a dragon when I was little, but I think it's a wyvern or something like that. So I always followed Somerset, even when they were rubbish. I go back to the Rose Denning days before Viv Richards came along and Garner and things, and I followed them right the way through that. There was an anniversary recently of their first big success in the Gillette Cup, I think 79. I was in the crowd that day and saw Viv Richards, I think, score 100, and it was brilliant. And Crew, my other things, again, superly bizarre reason. Used to have Shoot, the old magazine, some will from that generation, used to have League Ladders, and they stuck him in every Sunday morning. I'd sit down, people come, update League Ladders, because I was as sad then as I am now. And Crew were always at the bottom. And the very first frame I ever went to was Wimbledon Crew at the Old Plough Lane. And most of the people I was going with supporting Wimbledon, so just to be different, I supported Crew. It was a one-all draw, and been a Crew supporter ever since, largely because of a number of good young players that come through that I've seen down the years, from Bruce Grobbelaar, Jeff Thomas, Clapp, Ashton, Hulse, all of those, you've seen them come through. And even though we're struggling a little bit to produce those sort of players these days, and you can't sell them up as high up the leagues these days because the spectrum of football finances means that, you know, there's such a huge gulf between big and small, you're having to sell them up the leagues and get add-ons. But I still don't enjoy Saturday afternoons too much normally, because all I'm hearing is them getting beat. We've got a good side this year though, and we may well give sides a run for your money. So that's the main sporting thing, but unfortunately really the hobby became the job, and I've never really found a hobby to replace it. Racing remains the best. I'm lucky to work in it, and you just hope that maybe you can convey your enthusiasm to others, and everyone who's, you know, maybe sitting and watching and listening to this, you've got this far, you've done really well. Basically, if it's your sport, go out and sell it. Don't be afraid of it. You know, the whips and all of this sort of thing, just educate. It's a great sport, and I'm very, very lucky to have been involved in it.
This will be the final approach, I think, with only about 40 seconds or so to go. Turn away from the starter initially. And the runners about to make their way out onto the course then for our feature race of the afternoon.
Download the Star Sports app from the App Store or Google Play. All of the Star Sports markets, including in-play, all easily accessible from your phone or tablet. begambleaware.org. Over 18 only.